Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This is episode 185. We are very, very excited to be getting very near our 200th episode. It has been an awesome 4 years. 4 years, Mary.
Oh my God.
It's crazy. Because also it coincided with when I moved in with you.
True. Sandy.
And then when you started your professional brewing
that
career,
is
really.
All
or when
of
you,
this.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. I am because of this show. Thank you, Fomeba. Thank you, listeners. Thanks for the support. Thanks to all the guests. I mean, good God. Learned so much in all of these questions.
Oh,
so,
thanks, babe.
And thank you to Heritage Radio Network. This station is just absolutely incredible. All the shows. But this city is awesome. What's happening in the city, Mary?
Well, let's start with Thursday night. We have to mention, so if you're a regular listener, you'll know that Chris and Kelly Taylor, who owns Kelso Brewing Company here in New York City, they're doing a series of beer trolley brewery tours in New York City. Now that we have enough
refurbished trolleys
and breweries.
And breweries. Okay.
Oh, yeah, also breweries.
Anyway, so they did one about a month ago, right?
Yes.
And you're having the next one is Thursday night. Your visit, it's called what, The Outer Limits?
The Outer Limits. So we're going to the edges of Queens. We're starting at LIC Beer Project, kind of the edge of Long Island City. Then we're headed to Finback and then up to Single Cut. We're doing Bridge and Tunnel also, and then up to finishing at Single Cut, kind of, except the trolley is going to bring anybody back to LIC Beer Project.
Which isn't too far, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Anyway, so it is sold out, unfortunately.
It is, unfortunately. But we say all this to say that, you know, stay tuned for the next one, which will go on public announcement and sale probably in 1 week's time, and it's going to be, I think, January 12th, going to the Bronx, so beer in the
Ooh.
Bronx. And I know that's
the
a place.
Best way to get to the Bronx is by trolley.
Yeah, so. Darn straight. Or show up in the Bronx, and a trolley will take you around the Bronx. So that will visit Gun Hill's new satellite location. We'll visit Gun Hill, where I'm currently brewing, actually, helping out over there. And then we'll go to Chelsea Brewing Company and Bronx Brewing Company.
Oh, awesome.
What else is coming up in February?
Ooh, February. This is very, very exciting. It is Homebrew Alley number 11. So the New York City Homebrewers Guild has been hosting one of the East Coast's largest homebrew competitions, AHA, BJCP sanctioned homebrew competitions. You can go to homebrewalley.com. Account registration is open. We will be holding it at Alewife on February 10th and February 11th. We are accepting registrations until February 12th. Wait, that'd be too late. You'd miss the whole deal. Anyway, starting now until then, there's going to be a deadline date, cutoff date. Go to homebrewalley.com. We could use stewards. We could use judges. If you are in the tri-state area, please go there to sign up and lend your palate
or
assistance.
If you just want to come to New York City and you're looking for a good excuse, this is one of them.
Yeah, that's right. On that Saturday night at Alewife, there's always a huge party, and we celebrate the winners. And Alewife is an amazing beer bar in Long Island City and worth the visit alone. So please join us. And submit entries if you are a homebrewer.
So we're coming into, uh, we're we're past Thanksgiving. We're headed down to the December holidays. So maybe you're starting to think about gifts. And I thought it'd be cool if we talked about, we've had some of our guests have either launched or are launching companies or have some really cool things that would make excellent gifts. So I want to start with Jessica Sennett of Cheese Grotto. She was on, flipping through my tabs, she was on episode 142. And she has launched the Cheese Grotto. She has.
Right.
If you go to Cheese Grotto, that's GROTTO.com. What is the Cheese Grotto? Well, Stephen Jenkins, who's a world-renowned cheese specialist, says that this century-old device is the right and only way to keep and store cheese. Her Cheese Grottos are now available. They're actually made in Virginia, which is really cool. And she has an exclusive offer through December 31st. It's $350 for the Grotto. You get $50 towards a Formaggio Kitchen Cheese of the Month Club, and you get free shipping. So check that out for all of the cheese lovers in your life. Next up is, actually, we've had, I think, all three of these people on. It's Beerbox. And I didn't look up the episode, but beerbox.co, and that's
my friends Daily Crafton and Joey Dennert, homebrewers. Daily Crafton, both of them are members of the Brewminaries here in New York City. Daily Crafton is an old regular of mine at Beer Street. They're working together with another host of a show here on Heritage Radio Network, Harry Rosenblum, and to make Beerbox, B-I-E-R-B-O-X .co. And basically they are homebrew kits, very simple, accessible, easy to execute recipes that will be shipped to your door on a quarterly. They feature one recipe per quarter, I believe, something like that. And it's a great subscription.
Yeah, you get a kit every 3 months. Or you can buy a one-time gift.
Right.
Or send it as a gift.
Right. And I think a lot of the target audiences are for homebrewers that, new brewers or old brewers that don't have a whole lot of time to do the shopping, window shopping, and to design the recipes and take the time to do that. They just want to go in, get it done, and also have the pride of having fermented it. They're project-minded, but don't want to go necessarily crazy into that recipe design stage.
And they're actually doing a Kickstarter. They're going to ship in time for the holidays. So if you go to beerbox.co, that's, again, B-I-E-R-B-O-X.co, they have a link to their Kickstarter. So I think that would make another excellent gift. I also want to mention that Brian Hall, who was one of our guests, we had him originally on episode 32. And then I think we had him again when we talked to him again at the National Homebrewers Conference this year. But he has the blog Brewery Chuga, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong. I think I always do. But anyway, he has a great gift guide on his blog. So it's Browery, Browerij-Chuga, chuga.com. We'll put these links up.
I want some of your Browery Chuga.
On the Facebook. But he has a great gift guide, and he talks specifically about brewing, including the Anova Sous Vide Pressure Precision Cooker, which Chris and I have at home, and we've talked about before, using both for beer and a variety of food and other things. Converted my starches to sugar in my sweet potatoes for Friendsgiving that last week with our Anova sous vide.
And your regular yogurt making?
Yes, that's cranking. How I make my yogurt as well. But anyway, he has a great list on Browery Chuga, so check that out. And last but not least, of course, a great gift would be a membership to
the
Heritage Radio
gift
Network.
Ever.
So, obviously, if you meant about it, we're part of the Heritage Radio Network family. Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported, not-profit radio station devoted to all things food and beverage. So, right now, we especially need your support. Our end-of-the-year fundraiser is going on. We have a variety of rewards that you can get.
Oh, yeah, there's some new pot holders that we have.
There's one.
We're looking at one right now in the severed head of a taxidermied pig.
Boar.
He's very happy.
He loves it. He absolutely loves it. And we have some beer
teething.
Koozies,
I think that's
too.
What's going on.
Keep your beer temperate.
There's also other member benefits like monthly best of playlists. There's lots of swag, discounted events, tickets, members only parties, and all kinds of good stuff. So if you'd like to donate, either join yourself and or give a gift of membership, you can go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Let me tell you, there is no party like a Heritage Radio Network party.
What? Because a Heritage Radio party don't stop unless we lose funding, which is where you come in.
Truth.
Speaking of party, what a great episode we have today. Our guest today is intriguing, enlightening, inspiring, and her name is Jenny Dorsey. Thank you for joining us on Heritage Radio.
Thank you for having me.
On Ferment About It. Tell us a little about yourself and what you do in the fermented world.
So my name is Jenny, and I'm a chef and culinary consultant based in New York City. I work in culinary consulting full-time, but on the side, my husband and I run this underground restaurant tasting series called I Forgot It's Wednesday. So that is like a creative palette for me. I get to go do whatever I'm kind of feeling at that moment, put together courses. So every 6 weeks or so, we have a group of people come over and we do seven courses of four courses of homemade cocktails. And it's kind of like run of the gambit of what you're going to have that night. Totally like unknown. The guests usually know maybe like 2 days in advance, and it's all sorts of interesting fermented foods or other culinary delights from around the world.
Awesome. So how did you get into the food world and eventually the fermentation world?
I started my career actually in management consulting and realized I totally hated it. So I had started my MBA. I left. I decided to go to culinary school, worked in restaurant kitchens, and decided that, hey, you know, I want to do something that's both food and business related. And I want to do something full-time in the food world. What does that mean? Spent a lot of time freelancing and trying to figure out my life, basically, for a few years. And it came down to having a business where I could do more like consulting for different food businesses and also having a creative outlet for myself and for my husband. So we started this dinner series as a way not only for us to experiment and be creative, but also as a way for the two of us to get a group of people together and have them connect on a deeper level. So within that, while we're getting people to talk to each other and talk to each other about, you know, bigger things than just like the weather or how the subways are running that day.
We love talking about that though.
We always start a conversation that way. We were saying, hey, well, you know, what would really challenge them is if we got more interesting food. When we first started, I was always nervous that people would be like turned off from things that they hadn't had before, or things that sounded weird, or maybe things they just are unfamiliar with. But especially as we really narrowed down our audience, I realized like the right kind of people who come are open-minded and they want to try new stuff. So I should put it out in front of them and see how they react, which is where the fermented foods came in. People love like learning about new foods. And when it's like fermented and fermented at home, they're usually so unfamiliar with what that palate tastes like or what that is on their palate. Besides, you know, having beer and wine, they're like, what's fermentation? What does that mean in food, or besides sauerkraut, you know? And it was met with such a positive like reception. I was like, I should learn more about this or find different ways to incorporate it in my cuisine.
Awesome. So what was it? What were some of your beginner ferments?
My first one I ever did was fermented tea leaves, which is really popular in Burma. And I've not been to Burma, but Burmese cuisine is strangely very popular in San Francisco, which I lived for a year or so. And I went to their like namesake big Burmese restaurant out there called Burma Superstar, and they have this tea leaf salad, and I was like totally blown away by just all the textures and flavors going on. I just never had anything like it, slash never thought of fermenting tea leaves, slash never thought to eat it as a salad. Like, what was going on? My cheeks, I don't understand. But yeah, it's basically green tea leaves that in Burma, apparently they take the best tea leaves. It's like such a big deal that they take the very best ones, they wash them, and they ferment them in a certain way with, you know, their, I guess, like their secret mix of things. At home, I usually do a mix of different seasonings, like Maggi seasoning, which is from the region, garlic, shallots, lime juice, stuff like that. And they plate it in a salad bowl with all these crunchy nuts, crunchy fried garlic, crunchy shallots with some lettuce, and you mix it all together. It's like very DIY. Apparently it's like a peace offering in their culture. Like in the olden days, it's like very much this like all immersive culinary experience.
So when you say you mix it with all those things, how long do you let it sit? Are you using salt with these tea leaves? What's
the fermentation process with the tea leaves?
Yeah, so you you wash it, you dry it, and make sure it's, you know, like it's damp and it's not like soggy. And then I spin it in a food processor with all, like, with, there's some salt in there. There's some sort of acid, whether it's like lime juice or vinegar, garlic and shallots and peanut oil and such. I put it in a vacuum bag and seal it. And I ferment everything at home in my wine cooler. That's my, like, secret idea, thought of it, you know. Putting things in the pantry was starting to worry me. Like, I don't know what temperature my pantry is.
Sure.
So I would stick it in the wine cooler, usually like 60 or 65 degrees, and leave it for about a week. And then you take it out after a week or so and see how you feel about the taste. As it goes on, it gets a little funkier. It gets a little bit more sour, but not like in a tart way, just kind of a nuanced sour taste, which is good if that's what you're looking for. But at the same time, you're considering all the other things that go into the salad. So you don't want it to be too salty or sour and overpower everything else. So, yeah.
Cool.
So could I just go home and open a tea bag and ferment that? Or is there like a, do they have to be fresh tea leaves?
No, you can use dried ones. You just, you have to boil them like with a little bit of vinegar and water and then drain them again so that they're rehydrated and you pick out anything. Like if you don't have like super, super nice tea leaves, there's usually some sticks in it. So you have to pick out all the sticks and make sure it's only like soft tea leaves. I usually use like a nice grade, like Japanese sencha tea, green tea sort of thing. I let them sit overnight in cold water before blending everything else in it. And yeah, it's pretty simple, and you can use it with any, you can use a different type of tea leaf if you like.
Oh, wow. So it is super accessible. I wonder why it hasn't caught on. I've never heard of Burmese tea salad before. I wonder why it hasn't caught on in New York.
I know.
Undersung cuisine, though.
Yeah, it's so weird because, you know, New York is the pioneer in everything, and it, like, nobody has it here. And it's like kind of, yeah, it's totally this like interesting, crunchy experience that I haven't had before.
That's interesting. So Chris and I recently have gotten into Himalayan food, mm-hmm. which is kind of related, but we've had some fermented foods in those cuisines that we had never heard of either. So I think, you know, there's just a lot of cuisines that ferment stuff and we never, you know, it's really hard.
It's such a preservation method, you know, because they didn't have refrigeration and they were finding out different ways to make their food last longer and all these like wonderful things happen to it.
Yes. Yeah. And you get a lot of other aromas and flavors involved in it as well. Well, we're going to take a very brief break and we'll be right back with more Jenny Dorsey.
Ferment about it.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sauchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sauchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sauchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This is episode 185, and we are here in the studio with Jenny Dorsey of I Forgot It's Wednesday. We were just talking about a fermented dish, a Burmese dish, fermented tea leaves. And I just want to note that I've long wanted to do a show on what they call fermented tea leaves, or pu'er is one of my favorite teas in China. And I've got a friend named Derek Lam who runs a tea shop out there. But it's important to note that those
out there are, being Hong Kong.
Out there, being Hong Kong. My parents live in Hong Kong. I know it's hard to tell. My accent is... Anyway, yes, we're going to talk about that kind of fermented tea leaf, which is not actually fermented. It's actually just more of an aged thing, and which is really fun, but it's way different than a lacto-ferment that we just spoke of. Mary, you had one announcement that you really wanted to get to real quick.
No, I was just going to mention, since we were talking about Burmese cuisine and Himalayan cuisine that our friend Joe DeStefano is actually leading a Queen's Dinner Club Treks to Tibet on December 12th from 7 to 10 p.m. in Jackson Heights. And you can search for it on Eventbrite. So I was just going to say that's worth a mention because I think the cuisine that we've had, at least, that's in that, we haven't been to a strictly Burmese restaurant, I don't think, yet. But it's really worth checking out and really delicious, and this is a good opportunity to try.
Jenny, you do a lot of other kind of really fun ferments. We were just talking about a break. Yeah. What are some of those, and what do you get into, and where are they coming from?
One of my favorites is this Thai sour pork that I started having when I was in Thailand. I went there last year with my husband on our honeymoon. Nice. And, I mean, there's a lot of amazing food in Thailand, but obviously you have to eat a lot of street food. And so there was always these sausage vendors everywhere. And so I went through this like phase where I would like every day I would have a new type of sausage. It was great. And there was this amazing fermented sausage that I didn't know what they were doing. I was like so addicted to it. It's like a little bit savory. It's really sour in like a good way. The texture is really nice. And it's called the fermentation process there is called Naim. I don't know if I'm saying that properly. And they cure ground pork with pig skin, and they put it into a sausage casing, and it's really great. And so when I got home, I was researching a little bit more about that and came across this blog called She Simmers. It's like a food blog. And she was talking about how she uses the same technique on pork ribs. So I was like, I have to try this. This sounds so amazing. And it's actually a pretty simple curing process. You take raw pork ribs, you stuff them in some sort of container. I use a vacuum bag because I think it's generally like, just seems safer to me versus putting it in a jar and doesn't fit properly with the ribs. And you coat it in this mixture of cooked rice, garlic, and salt. You have to get the ratio somewhat in the right category.
Cooked rice.
Yeah. So, yeah. And you like get that mixture all nice and sticky, get it all over your ribs. You stuff it in the vacuum pack container, put it in your wine fridge, and you let it sit for like 3 to 5 days, depending on how tart you want to get it. And it's like amazing. The rice forms this interesting crust around the ribs. You bake them off to finish, so you can't like eat them raw. I guess you could, but I don't. You can fry them, you can bake them off, and they're incredible. You can do the same with beef. You can do it with lamb. Do not do it with poultry. But yeah, it's amazing. I like. I've been trying to get that in every menu. Everybody needs to eat this.
That's wow. Awesome.
Do you have any insight into what that kind of process is? Of what it's doing?
I am not sure. I mean, it's interesting to me that it's cooked rice. I feel like the rice must be releasing something. And I don't know. Like playing with garlic always kind of made me wary. So that, that together, I was like, oh, I don't know. But I don't know what it is. It takes on this interesting, like, nuanced depth that you just wouldn't get from pork originally. And if when you do it with beef, it tastes completely different. But I feel like it's, like, deepening the flavor of the pork or the beef, which is fascinating.
It's probably a lacto or some other bacteria. Yeah. I'm guessing lacto. Drinking.
Yeah, from the cooked.
Yeah, from basically how you're describing how it tastes. And I don't know.
We got to try that.
I know.
Does it work with fish?
I don't know if I would do it with fish. It makes me a little bit nervous.
All right, Chris, you got to try it.
I'm all for it. I'm already planning it.
So let's talk about fermented berber. And I always pronounce. How do you pronounce
it? I think it is berber, but berber. I don't know.
Can you spell it for the listeners?
B-E-R-B-E-R-E.
Is this the
Ethiopian? Tell us what it is.
Yeah. So it's berber is kind of like the essential Ethiopian like spice blend, kind of like what garam masala is for Indian food. Mm-hmm. So it's the foundation that they use use it for a lot of other things. So in its core, it's like a chili spice blend. It's dry. It's usually a deep red color. I think berber is kind of meant to be the middle like spicy middle variety in terms of spiciness. So there's like a milder one and like a more spicy one. So the chilies that they use is like the medium one. But yeah, you can use it's everybody has their own kind of like version of it, and it's, you know, done to eye, and like every mom has kind of their own thing. But yeah, I went to this really interesting class with an Ethiopian chef in San Francisco, and he was talking about his own heritage, and he was talking about how he makes up like a stickier paste from it. And this happened as I was making the tea leaves the first time. And I was like, what if I just made this paste and then I stuck it in the wine fridge with the tea leaves and what will happen? And it's like this really lovely, like toned down version of a spicy berbere sauce. It's still got like the heat kind of in the back from the chilies. It's got a little bit of that garlic situation because I added some garlic, but also like has paprika, has these nigella seeds and basil seeds. It's like very earthy with some top lemon notes, well-rounded. It's like, it's amazing with beef. I just like smother it on everything. You can eat it with rice. That sounds awesome.
I love Ethiopian food. And somebody actually just brought us a big sack of berbere. And I haven't done anything with it. I saw that Marcus Samuelson actually had an article, or like he had like a bunch of things to do with berbere sauce, and I kind of had actually pinned it on my Pinterest board. But this is inspiring me even more so. This sounds awesome. And for people that, where do you get your berbere?
I make it from like a variety of different spices, but I think you can buy them pre-made at some of the bigger, you know, like the spice, like hallucinogens I bet.
I mean, that's where I got my original, and then somebody brought me some from somewhere in the. Somewhere else in the country, I don't remember. But you can probably order it if you want to buy berbere. So you make your berbere from scratch completely. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a process, but it's worth it. And, like, they have their own, like, special spice butter that you have to cook all the meat in before you put the berbere. And, it's, like, a very involved sort of thing. But
are you looking at how to pronounce it? What is Google berbere. Translate
say? I've always said berbere, but it is berbere.
Berber. Is that Google Translate?
Berber.
Oh, is that pronunciation manual?
It's a little bit like Gerber.
Yeah, like Berber.
There we go.
Berber.
This came out because, over Thanksgiving, Chris and I had a, I call them giblets, and Chris calls them giblets.
Giblets.
That's, you know, what comes from the inside of the turkey. Giblets. So I never really thought about it. I just said giblets. But it turns out the most common pronunciation is giblet.
Mary's once again more right than me. But we're both right. So.
But ever since then, now we've been like looking up how to pronounce everything on the internet. So that will explain that. So let's talk about what else. You also have done a fermented duck broth.
Yes, that was kind of a play, actually, now that we've been talking about the soured ribs. I cooked the duck initially. I do this like rub duck breast. And then because I take the whole duck down for it, I'll take the carcass, roast it off, and then break down little pieces and do a similar ferment as with the Thai soured ribs, which makes me a little less nervous because the duck's already cooked, I hope. And so I'll do that in the refrigerator. And after it's been smothered in on all the good rice stickiness for a couple days, then I'll take the bones out and then cook it with the rice and make a stock out of it. And it's like an interesting, it's not too duck flavored. I feel like it mellows out the duck a little bit, which is interesting. And you can use it as like a braising liquid for a lot of other things, such as the berbere short ribs. It adds like this interesting kind of like, slightly tart sort of, there's like, I don't know how to describe it besides when you eat it, you're like, there was like some interesting tartness there that I don't know where it came from. Yeah. So yeah, I really love what it does. And it's like so subtle. So people will never talk about it because it's not enough to be like, oh, did you taste that? But I think when people go home, they think about it. And so that's the draw.
And I think that's something that's important when we talk about fermentation, not only because if you're fermenting something because you're making alcohol or you're making something that has a lot of probiotics in it, but because a lot of fermented foods have that extra oomph to them. Mm-hmm. Like I'm a vegetarian the majority of the time, and I've been using my house-made miso, and also actually I do pescatarian, I guess, but I just got some bourbon barrel aged fish sauce, and I think like those kind of fermented, like soy sauce, those kind of fermented foods just add that extra zing to them. So that's another reason to ferment, to use some of these fermented foods, is not only for the probiotic, the health factor, but also to add this extra depth to your food that you can't get any other way.
Yeah, one of my two favorite like fermented cooking ingredients, I mean, besides the fermented fish sauce, is fermented black beans and fermented broad bean sauce, which is like a I'm not actually sure what the bean looks like, but it's a brown sauce, more common in Thai cooking. So the black beans are really, it's like everywhere in Chinese food. Mm-hmm. They're really salty and they're very fermented. And if you like grind them up and kind of like sprinkle them in something else, it's like an interesting, especially if you're making some Italian food, you like sprinkle some fermented black beans in there. People are like, what's happening?
That is awesome.
Like, there's something in this I just can't quite place. Like, yeah. I bet you wouldn't have guessed it. And the broad bean sauce, they classically use it in this mixture. They do like this poached chicken and rice dish. And the chicken's like really, really gently poached in just some water and some like, I think there's like garlic in there, but just like very gentle. And then they make this really pungent sauce that kind of goes with it. So you get a little like poached chicken, pungent sauce, chicken fat, rice, and it's like this beautiful, harmonious like situation. So
the fermented broad bean is, do you buy the,
I buy it in a Thai grocery.
Okay. Just like, okay, cool.
Your husband does the mixology at the dinners. Does he ever use any vinegar or shrubs or any sort of fermented liquids to spice up some of his
That's his new
cocktail?
Thing. Is it? Oh, man, we have so many shrubs going in our... I'm like, oh,
so let's do a revisit of what a shrub is. We've had some shrub shows before, but...
A shrub, I guess, is slightly fermented. It's like a version of... but you can make shrubs out of anything, but he's been making these like rhubarb shrubs. So rhubarb with a little bit of vinegar and let it kind of like sit and let the natural sugar starches come out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was technically.
And probably the vinegar pull. I'm guessing the vinegar pulls out other things too. And the fruit, like when I've made shrubs before, I think it's also, you know, because vinegar has a lot of acidity. So it's pulling a lot of flavors out that you might not get mm-hmm. by doing a regular tea infusion or something like that.
I was curious.
He makes this really good rhubarb. Well, not right now, but you know when we had lots of rhubarbs. Yeah, it's a rhubarb shrub, and it's interesting because rhubarb is one of those like it's naturally tart already, so usually it's covered up with lots of sugar. So doing a shrub with rhubarb is actually such a good way to naturally enhance the fruit. And people are like, oh wow, I didn't really know rhubarb tasted like this because I've been so used to having rhubarb pie that you know tastes really sweet.
Yeah, that's true.
How many people do you usually entertain for these dinners?
It depends. So for our small dinners, we do 12. And mm-hmm. then for larger pop-up events, we do anywhere from 30 to 100. We've done one 100-person dinner. That was like our very first big person dinner. And it was a little crazy. It was like
that's a big dinner.
It was we were not prepared. We had been doing this dinner as kind of like this. Oh yeah, this is like cool. We'll have some of our friends, and then we'll have friends of friends, and now we have a couple strangers. And then we got into this idea that we should do a 100-person dinner and rent out this huge place in the Lower East Side to do it. And this was what two and a half years ago now. So we've learned so much by then, but. Man, like that first dinner, basically, or that first big dinner, essentially everything went wrong. Like we ordered this tree. It was supposed to be 10 feet. We got an 8-foot tree, and then we got a 15-foot tree, and then the beer came without taps. And then like all these people showed up really early, and the tables weren't configured, and it was insanity. My intern burned half my hors d'oeuvres. I mean, oh, no. I was just like, what is happening today? Yeah.
So do you have some that are open to public? Or?
Yeah, all are totally open to public. We just send out tickets via a listserv. So if you just sign up on our website, which is, I forgot, it's wednesday.com, we have a mailing list, and we'll be releasing some tickets for our January dinner probably this weekend.
Awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So we'll be on the lookout for both your dinner and for a Chris's trolley thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
perfect compliments to each other, yeah.
You had fun today. You made cheese today, Rachel.
Yeah,
tell
I
us
got,
of your cheese making today.
I got out of one of my jobs early today, and since I had some time on my hands, I'm like, why don't I make some cheese? So I picked up some rennet last week.
As one does.
Yeah, so I had actually picked up some rennet and citric acid.
Ooh, where'd you end
week.
Up getting the rennet?
I did end up getting it from the place you told me to go.
Kalushians?
Yeah, Kalushians. Okay. Which I spent like an hour just like looking through the whole place. I was like, everything I ever wanted is here.
Yeah.
20 kinds of paprika. Amazing. Also, a lot of rennet. I also got suckered into buying the cheese salt, which, spoiler for everybody, it's just salt. It's just salt. Ingredients, salt. All right. Whatever. Cheese salt. So I made some mozzarella today. This I made several hours ago. I brought a little bit. It's not quite as stretchy as they want it to. I haven't tried it, so you guys are going to be my taste testers, I guess.
Were you following a recipe that you found online?
I found it on Pinterest.
You found it on Pinterest.
Yeah, basically. It was see if I can remember my thing. So I dissolved the citric acid and the rennet separately in little bits of water. I poured almost a gallon. I didn't have room in my pot for the whole gallon of milk. Not ultra-pasteurized, but it was homogenized and pasteurized because that's what they had in the store. Then I added the citric acid on low heat for a little while, and then the rennet, and then you take it off the flame. You put a cover on the pot and let it sit for 5 minutes, and then it starts to like look kind of like tofu. And you split it up into curds, like with a knife, and stir it for a little while. Keep stirring it, and then after a while, it forms some bigger curds. Strain them out. And then what the interesting part is, after you strain out the curds, you're going to heat up the whey again and then put the curds back in there so that the curds get really stretchy when they're at like 135 degrees. But you want them separate. So I didn't have a slotted spoon for some reason. I don't know where my slotted spoon went. So I
had
actually,
that same issue.
Yeah, I know I have one. I don't know where it is. So I ended up using the small plastic strainer that I use for kefir instead of a slotted spoon, and it probably worked better because it holds more. Mm-hmm. And then I heated that up and then kind of took the hot cheese. I didn't buy the gloves that it told me to buy, so I had hot hands, and folded it over, stretched it over as much as I could, and that was it. And then put it in the fridge.
Awesome.
It actually only took about 40 minutes, but it was like I was paying attention the whole time.
Cool.
Right.
Yeah, and I had to buy a thermometer, which was actually a really good investment. Definitely recommend buying a digital thermometer for anybody who doesn't have one.
Yes, that's an excellent holiday gift. Yeah.
That is a great holiday
for pretty much
gift.
Anybody that does fermentation, I think. Just there's always something that you're going to use it for.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys want to try this mozzarella cheese? Yeah.
So while you're divvying that up, I want to go back to fish sauce.
Yes.
Fish sauce is something I grew up in the rural Midwest, so I wasn't exposed to very many cuisines when I was little. So I didn't grow up with a lot of the food that I now eat regularly. And like fish sauce is one of those things that I probably didn't encounter till I was in my late 20s, I'm guessing. And I love it. Chris is a little more hesitant because
low doses and blended into the right environment, it's awesome. And as long as it's not a noticeable fish zing, and it's just a zing, I'm into it. You know?
But I made... I made a chicken chili verde in my pressure cooker last year, and it was a Serious Eats recipe, and they added a dish. That was my first like dash of fish sauce. So I've used fish sauce in a lot of stuff, and I just bought actually at Kalushian's this bourbon barrel aged fish sauce, which is very different. And actually Kalushian's has like 10 or 15 different kinds of fish sauce. I'm guessing they have a lot, maybe not that many, but they had a lot more than I've seen before. But I think that, and now I've been adding it to almost everything. Like I added a little bit when I made vegetarian stuffing stuffing without turkey in it, and I used a dash of the fish sauce. I used a dash of the fish sauce actually in the gravy that I made. Mm-hmm. I've just been adding just to give it that extra zing. But what are some of your favorite things to use?
I think fish sauce is like a perfect finishing salt. Like if you I think it goes, besides obviously going well with Southeast Asian cuisine, it goes really well with Spanish and Mexican cuisine. I don't know what it is. Spanish too, like, you know, because they have a lot of fish, but yeah, like something about adding it to tomato sauce. My favorite. So I make this tomato sauce. Everyone's like, what's in this sauce? It's tomatoes, lots of mushrooms, and fish sauce. And I'm like, I'm telling you, that is the magical combination. Like, no, don't tell any Italian grandma. They'd be like, oh my God, throw her out. But yeah, it's amazing. With Mexican cuisine, it's so good. I learned in Vietnam when I was there that it's one or the other, Vietnamese fish sauce and Thai fish sauce. One is with anchovies and the other one with sardines. Mm-hmm. But they're relatively interchangeable unless you have like a really delicate palate. I usually use Red Boat. It's like they have, they're like virgin pressed. I don't know what it means.
I think the bourbon barrel one is made by Red.
Oh, okay.
The one that I bought. Yeah.
They have like, so the numbers on the fish sauce, like 40, 50 or 60, it just tells you how much percentage of fish sauce to water. So it's really like, if it was 100% fish sauce, it'd be like way too much.
Yeah.
So the 60% one's going to be a little bit more intense than the 40N1 or however they designate it. But it's like I put it on everything, unless obviously I'm making something vegetarian. But yeah, it's really good if you're like mixing any of your fermented, all these fermented foods is like really nice with fish sauce. And it doesn't really taste like fish, I don't think.
No, so I know, especially like if you're using it as a, like you said, as basically a condiment. Mm-hmm. And there is an Italian fish sauce too.
Oh, actually. Yep.
And they had that at Colutions. I've never seen it. We had a guest, Rob Handel, we've had on a couple of times, and he's making his own fish sauce mm-hmm. from scratch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but, and I really want to make some too, but I don't.
What kind of fish?
Your cats will go crazy.
That's true.
Oh, my God.
Also, like, we'd have to fresh catch fish, and I totally know how to clean a fish, but I haven't. Yeah, we can't do that. East River fish would not work in fish sauce.
That had an interesting nuance to it.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably get one fresh at one of the fish markets. Yeah, but anyway. But yes, fish sauce. It's like one of my favorite new condiments. And
so good.
I feel like I haven't explored it fully. So Chris is so excited.
Ignorance is bliss.
That's true.
There's so many like strange fermented things. After I started getting into fish sauce, I would like walk down the fermented aisle at like the Chinese or like Thai supermarkets. And it's like, what are all these things? Fermented tofus and fermented like mustard greens, also really good. There's this like really kind of disgusting looking fermented tofu. Food that's good that comes in jars and you like eat it with rice.
It's all sorts of tofu.
Yeah, there's stinky tofu. It's stinky tofu is like actually dry and it's also stinky, but like they have this other like wet slimy one. I'm not describing it in a great way, but it's like strangely good and kind of addictive. It's like one of those acquired tastes.
I've never had that.
Yeah, it's like great. It comes in a, like a very shockingly drab gray jar. It's like in this pool of liquid. You're like, what is this? But it's so good.
Awesome. Well, so your website again is
iforgotitswednesday.com. Come hang out with us at a dinner sometime.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on. I'm very inspired to go home and ferment some good stuff. I didn't ferment anything over my Thanksgiving staycation, I'm ashamed to say. I did cook a lot, but I definitely have some fermentation dreams, especially now. So thank you so much.
Ferment all the meats.
Yeah. Ferment all the things. Yeah.
Jenny Dorsey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I forgot it's Wednesday. Ferment about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.